Blog Talk Radio.
Edition of Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. Great to have you with us today. Today we're going to be talking about real estate, one of my favorite subjects to talk about. And our guest today is Wendy Warren. Wendy Warren has been a part-time real estate agent for 14 years. She currently works with Palmer House Properties, specializing in residential buying and selling of homes in the Metro Atlanta area, plus Macon, Athens, and Columbus, Georgia. But she considers herself to be more of a buyer's agent. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. She is a certified property manager and has 8 years of experience handling the short sale process of selling properties, and we'll also talk about that. So welcome to Your Personal Finance, Wendy Warren. Hello, Wendy. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. Thank you for having me on.
Yes. So we're real excited. So we're going to get into to make sure I don't forget to talk about a buyer's agent and the short sale process. But I wanted to talk about the things that people need to do before they, you know, actually buy a house. You know, like, for example, talk about cleaning up your credit score. What's a range of well, is there a minimum credit score you need to buy a house in this day and age?
Yes, you do. You need a minimum score of 620.
620,
in order to get the process started.
So in doing that, to walk us through some of the things that they need to do. So, for example, cleaning up your credit score. So if you don't have a 620, because the credit score is important because that will determine your interest rate, right, and other type of requirements that might be necessary.
That's
what
correct.
What other things does this credit score impact in terms of buying a house? Is anything else that will impact? Just mainly the interest rate? Is that pretty much it?
It's whether or not, first of all, whether or not you qualify, and then, of course, the interest rate that you qualify for. Those are two of the most important things.
Okay.
And then, of course, eventually the house that you could afford, meaning the amount of house.
The amount of house. In other words, would you be able to afford $1 million house or or $100,000 house? Okay, that makes sense. Should you figure out, what your anticipated monthly payments are going to be? Is that something you should think about?
That is one of the first things that you should do. Away from actually figuring out where is it that you want to live, yes, determining exactly what you want to pay each month. And that will actually help you to figure out the price of the house, you know, the price range that you want to go.
Okay. So that's important. In other words, the price range, so making the monthly payment. Is it safe just to assume that, assuming that before someone buys a house, they're staying somewhere. Is it safe to assume that you could probably afford a house that, let's say, where you're currently renting? So if you're renting a house for, let's say, $1,000 a month, would it be commonsensical to say, well, I could probably afford a mortgage payment for $1,000, or is that just too simplistic?
No, actually, you're absolutely right. If you can afford $1,000 just easily without any issues at all, obviously you'll be able to afford the same thing, paying for your own home, of course. Yes, you are correct.
Okay. Yeah, so that makes sense. And that's an easy way. If you can, you know, pay a rent payment pretty easily with money left over at the end of the month or after you pay all your bills, and that's safe to say that you could probably afford a house, you know, for that. With today's just using that as a barometer, I'm gonna put you on the spot here. For $1,000 at current interest rates, how much house could someone afford, you think, in a range? What should they be looking for?
In terms of the price range, if they want to pay $1,000, what's the price range interest rate?
What size of house they would be able to afford, the value of the house, right?
I can't tell you the square feet, but I can tell you the value. It probably was somewhere from 150 to maybe 165, maybe 170. And that's depending on the interest rate that they get from that lender.
What's the current interest rate? This is May 28th, 2020. What's the range of rates you can expect now in the marketplace?
3.85 for 30-year, probably around 3.85 for 30 years, and maybe, want to say maybe 2.9 for 15 years.
Okay. Now explain the difference when you're talking about, I know you're not a mortgage banker, but I'm sure you've dealt with mortgages enough, the difference between a 30 and 15 year house, because even though the rate's lower, obviously your payment's going to be higher. What scenario would somebody get a 15-year versus a 30-year?
Okay. I could give you a couple of reasons. One is that you just want to pay off your mortgage faster.
Okay.
So that's one good reason to get a 15-year loan. You know that you will be able to – it's not double the amount that a 30-year would be. It might be – say, for example, if it was $1,000 on a 30-year, on a 15-year, you might get $1,500 for the month. So as long as you're able to afford that and you want to pay off your mortgage faster, that's the best way to go. And, of course, if you have the funds available each month to pay that bill. The second thing is, of course, if you're a little bit older and you don't want to do a stretch of 30 years, it's a good way to just do a 15-year to get it over with.
And so I guess part of that equation that you'd be dealing with is, how long you plan to stay in a house. Is this your, quote, forever home? In other words, this is it. This is your dream home. You don't plan on moving anymore. You're going to die in this home, so to speak. I guess that would make a difference. But if you plan on moving, if you think that this is like a starter home, then, probably you have to kind of weigh that. Do you want to pay more? In other words, in a 15-year, your mortgage is going to be higher. Therefore, you might not be able to qualify for as much, right?
That's correct.
Right.
And
so,
you are correct, too. I like what you just said. That would probably be the third reason. If you decided that, okay, I want to move within 5 years, or this is my starter home, as you just stated, then that's a good reason to get the 30-year, not the 15.
Right, right. And I think a lot of people don't think about that, when they're buying a home. Is this their, forever home? We're going to be here until we die, or this is just a starter home. We're starting to build a family, and we may outgrow this house, in 5-10 years down the road. Or if you're in a job where you might be moving, or you have the potential to be, relocated at a moment's notice, or with some advance notice to another opportunity that might exist in another city or state. In that case, how about getting pre-approved? Is that important to get pre-approved before you start looking for a house?
As a real estate agent, for me, it's the most important thing. When I just started out, I used to take folks out and not understanding that they need to be pre-approved beforehand. And we would find a house, they would fall in love with the house, and then try to get the loan. In the end, they might not qualify, and so we both wasted our time. So at this moment, I think that's the first thing. After deciding where you want to live, the kind of house that you want, the next thing is to get pre-approved. Once you're pre-approved, you know definitely the size, the price of the house that you can afford.
And you mentioned something that we didn't talk about is, you know, what are the things that maybe when we get into the real estate part, but that's something that we need to address, is that when you're looking to buy a home, what things you should look at, not just in the home, but also in the neighborhood you're going to be living in. Because, you know, when you move into a house, you kind of inherit the neighborhood, you know, the folks that live around you, the schools, the shopping, and, the growth potential and all those kinds of things. And I guess that's some of the things. So getting pre-approved is important because and that means what? They get a letter from the mortgage lender saying you're pre-approved for a certain amount, and I think that helps lets the seller know that you're pre-approved, and chances are this deal is going to go through for the most part, unless something terrible comes up, so I think that's an important process to go through. Anything else in terms of, before we get into the realtor side, on the things that you should do before buying a home, like looking at the neighborhood and that kind of stuff, and some other things that they should be considering and before they even start down the path of looking at homes?
Yeah, actually, you have a very good point of looking at the neighborhood, looking at the city that you want to live in. So, for example, if you have kids, you want to know that the school system is good. You want to do some checks with the local police station to make sure that this is not a neighborhood that they're being called out on a regular basis. There are just certain things that you could do on your own to verify that, okay, this is the city I want to be in. And then once you determine that, say, for example, you have found the house that you want, then you do your legwork and find out, the neighbors. You drive there at night just to see how the community is. Those are some of the things that you could do to make sure that what you're buying, you don't have buyer's remorse later on and say, I should have, could have.
And that's a good point, because when I first bought my home, my first home back in 1983, and believe it or not, interest rates were 12.5%.
And I remember those rates.
You remember those days? It was like nobody ever thought we'd see 3% and 4% interest rates. If you put a gun to any president of any bank and said, would interest rates ever go down to 3% or 4%, they would have absolutely said no way. But anyway, that was back then. And one of the things I did two to cardinal sins. I didn't look at the neighborhood. I didn't, in terms of schools. So I ended up having to bus my daughter across town to go to a more appropriate school that I felt was adequate for what her academic potential was. And I didn't look at crime, because the house got broken into, which could happen anywhere, but that's something I should have looked at. And then the amenities, what's around in the neighborhood, because, there was no grocery stores close by or anything like that. So, we had to go travel pretty, not far, but, we had to go, a good distance, 15, 20 minutes to go and, buy groceries and stuff like that. So those are the things that you need to look at. You make a good point. I never thought about driving at night to see if there's folks having parties in the street. Or one of my pet peeves is, if you see folks with cars jacked up in the highway, I'm sorry, jacked up in the driveway, and they're fixing them and stuff, and looking at how people take care of their house in the neighborhood,
Correct.
Anyway,
that's one of my things that I do.
Is that right? Okay. You help folks with that kind of process. And that's important to do. Anything else? So that's pretty much it. Looking at before you buy, make sure you pull your credit score, make your score is at least 620. Make sure you have an idea about what the monthly payments are going to be that you can afford.
Correct.
and then obviously getting pre-approved and looking at the neighborhood that you're living in. And I always, one of the things I think also that people need to be aware of is that, you know, looking at the rental payment, looking at what their monthly payment's going to be to make sure they're able to save money. Because one of the things, as you well know, that buying a house is different from renting, because if something goes wrong, you have nobody to call to come fix the toilet, to come, you know, handle any electrical problems or plumbing or anything like that that goes on. So you need to make sure you have money set aside to handle things in emergency and things like that.
Correct.
How much do you think they should? How much do you think they should set aside? How much do they have in savings? Let's use the example of a $1,000 mortgage. How much typically you should think that, you know, a new homeowner should have available in savings after they close on the loan?
Huh. Wow.
I would say
that
more than $5.
Of course. But that one is hard to come up with, depending on the price of the home and their lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. But say just a house for maybe $100,000, I would say to have at least $10,000 put aside for basic necessities throughout the year. And if nothing is used, I mean, from that $10,000, then you just keep building on top of that.
Right.
And believe me, when you don't have it, that's when something is going to happen. So it's better to have than not have.
Right. And the rule of thumb is like 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. So that $10,000 would probably be in that range somewhere, because that's the thing that, you know, because a new roof costs. Obviously, you're not going to be buying a new roof when you first buy a house, but you know, things can come up that you just that won't be covered by your homeowner's insurance. All right, good enough. All right, so let's jump into talking about how to work with a realtor. But before we do that, we're going to play a segment of Your Personal Finance, and then I'll be back with Wendy Warren, real estate agent.
Thank you.
A financial mistake that can be avoided with a little bit of magic. Find out what it is on today's Your Personal Finance.
Here's great news about a special introductory offer from the Wall Street Journal. Now, for a limited time, you can have 13 weeks of the Wall Street Journal delivered to your home or office every business day for just 57 cents a day, 25% off the Journal's regular price, for the world's most trusted source of business news and information, for the insights, analysis, and big picture thinking you need to make better decisions, more confident decisions. Decisions that can make all the difference to you, your family, and your future. So make a smart decision right now. See for yourself how you can profit from the knowledge you get from the Wall Street Journal every business day. Take advantage of the Journal's special introductory offer, 13 weeks for the low price of just 57 cents a day. This offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S. only.
Call now toll-free 1-800-262-7300. That's 1-800-262-7300 for the Wall Street Journal.
Saving for the future is the key to financial security. Having money in the bank gives you more control when there's an emergency and more flexibility when there's an unexpected opportunity. Yet many people mistakenly see saving money as an impossible goal. It doesn't have to be. Even if you only put aside a few dollars each week, start the habit now, and then watch the magic. You put money in a savings account, you earn interest, the interest is compounded, which means added onto your balance, and you earn interest on the higher amount. The best way to save is through payroll deduction, or having the bank withdraw money from your checking account and put it into a savings account. The most important thing is to decide what amount you can save each week, and then do it. For Your Personal Finance, I'm Charles Ross.
And we're back talking with Wendy Warren, a real estate agent, talking about how to buy a house. And so we kind of laid the groundwork on some of the things you need to do prior to, engaging a real estate agent. And now we're going to be talking about how to work with a realtor. So explain the whole how real estate agents are paid, Wendy.
Okay. So if that agent is a buyer's agent, they're actually paid by the seller. If it's the listing agent, they're also paid by the seller. Now, there are times when it's an investment property, and if you're buying an investment property, sometimes the commission level doesn't go up to the standard. So, for example, the standard or the minimum would probably be about $1,200, and on an investment property is about $500 that the listing agent is paying. In that case, the buyer then would probably agree to give the agent the additional amount to make it that minimum $1,200 that she's looking for with that transaction. So generally speaking, on sales away from the investment that I just mentioned, the buyers don't pay anything. The sellers
okay.
do.
So it's not a straight percentage, it's a minimum dollar amount then, more so.
It actually, with investment property, it's a dollar amount most of the time for the buying agent. For investment property, it's with the listing agent, it's generally speaking a percentage. On general residential, buying for your primary resident or selling for your primary resident, it is a percentage. So, for example, the typical in Georgia is 6%. The listing agent would agree, would set up an agreement with the seller for 6%, and then with that, they'll make a decision of whether or not to give the buyer's agent 3 or 2.5%, which is usually the lowest.
Okay. So basically, the rate is a standard 6% on residential, and then
correct.
Make it simple. The listing agent splits that with the buyer's agent.
Correct.
Okay. All right. You know. So in essence, the seller is paying a commission, basically.
Correct.
You know. All right. So with that being said, now can a seller pay higher than 6%?
They can, but generally speaking, they wouldn't want to.
Okay. All right. Because I know one of the things, you know, I've been around a long time. When I had my first house and bought a second house, I gave an incentive, and I had the standard rate of 6%. And then I added, and since I had just bought another house and had two mortgages, I gave an incentive to the listing, to any agent actually, you know, that I think it was like $1,500 if it sold in the first 30 days, $1,000 if it sold in 60 days, and $500 if it sold in 90 days, something like that, because I just wanted to get rid of it, you know what I mean? And that was available for any agent. So it didn't matter if you were the listing agent or the buyer agent. If you sold the property, you got all of that. You didn't split that with anybody in addition to whatever your regular commission.
The standard 6%.
Yeah. It was just a special situation for me. You know,
and
so that's
correct. I've actually done that on several deals where I offered the buyer's agent a bonus commission to get
okay.
that contract done. So, yes, that's a distinct possibility.
Now, you in your bio say you're a buyer's agent. Explain what that is. What's a buyer's agent versus a listing agent?
I actually was kind of pushed in that role. So when I started doing real estate, I had buyers, and then I just continually gotten referrals from those buyers for somebody else out of state who wants to buy a property in Georgia. So most of my sales in the last 14 years has been as a buyer's agent, but I am a listing agent too, but I still consider myself a buyer's agent since that's the bulk of where my business is.
Oh, yeah, and that makes sense because a listing agent, my understanding of it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a listing agent just, you know, secures properties to be sold. In other words, they're more interested in inventory, and, you know, they may not be as active on the buyer's side, driving people around to look at homes. They just want to have an inventory of product, and they're going to get paid no matter who sells it, even if it's them or somebody else. Whereas a buyer's agent, in your case, you're escorting people on tours to different properties, and that's a different kind of mindset, I guess, and marketing, I guess, approach to your business. But obviously, can a buyer work with a listing agent? Is that desirable?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
I have a listing right now that I'm in the process of working up the contract, and the buyer is also mine. So
okay.
Yes, we could do both at the same time.
Okay. Is there an inherent conflict of interest or some disadvantages to working for listing agents and also to be the buyer's agent? Because, from what I understand, the listing agent's obligation is to the seller and not necessarily the buyer. Is that kind of the way
you
work?
That's absolutely correct. Okay. So the scenario that I just told you about, in this case, I have accepted the buyer just as a customer, which is different from a client. And the seller is actually my client. So my duty as a real estate agent is to the seller. But I did take on that buyer as a customer. So it's limited duty. I'm being fair to both, but really my role is making sure that the seller is good.
Right. And that makes sense when you think about a business transaction. Whoever pays you is the one that gets your loyalty, I guess, so to speak.
There you go.
That's the appropriate way.
There you go.
If you're not paying me, yeah. And I get that. I mean, I get it. I've been in there, so I understand that part. But that's something people need to know when they're working. Because the second house I bought,
yes.
I don't think I had a real estate agent. I mean, it was in a subdivision where the developer was still there, and they had their representatives there, but it was limitations because it was building a house, so you had some limitations on what you can do, and I'm a pretty good negotiator, so I felt I could do it, but I may have came out better if I had an agent, but my agent stood me up for the tour, so I had to kind of go along with that one. All right, so buyer's agent, listing agent. You want, if you're getting a real estate agent, you want to make sure that your agent is representing you as a buyer's agent and not necessarily the listing agent. And that, does that have to be disclosed up front?
Yes.
Okay.
It definitely has to be disclosed because they need to know. The best way I can think of it is where your loyalty is.
Right. Right, where your loyalty is, and we talked about that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would think, in hiring a real estate agent, talk about how it's important to be respectful of a realtor's time. Talk about that, because I can imagine because you don't get – a buyer's agent doesn't get paid until a house is sold. And obviously, if you're, touring somebody around to different houses – you don't go get paid until something is sold. So talk about how you should be respectful of a realtor's time.
Oh, communication is so very important. If you're going to be late, if something changes in your life financially, if you have changed your mind, those are some of the things that need to be disclosed to that agent, because no matter what, that person is out there searching for you. And even if they're not physically going out, they're taking the time out of their day to do the necessary research on the properties based on your specification. So you need to tell them immediately if your choices are different. If you set up an appointment or you're going to be late, please let them know, even if you can beforehand, or if not, as soon as you know that something is going to cause you to be delayed, let that person know. It is so unfair, and I've been on that end where I am sitting there for 45 minutes and waiting for someone, and they don't call, and ultimately they don't show. And it's the most annoying feeling in the world to sit there and wait for a person and they don't show. So, yes, communication is the most important thing between agent and that client.
And be respectful, because like obviously it, and you know, I guess in part of that same conversation and being respectful of the realtor's time is, you know, making sure you, what's an appropriate number of properties to look at during one, you know, tour, I guess. You know, is it one or two, 10? What's the minimum number of properties
you
want to look at?
I can't say about everybody else, but for me, I have done 10 in one day, and that's just because I do work part-time as an agent. So my availability is not as someone who works a full-time agent. So I try to accommodate that client to make sure they have every opportunity to see the most houses at that one meeting, that one appointment, just because of how I work. But generally speaking, if someone works full-time and they have several clients that they have to see, I say maybe about 5 home for one person, I think, would be respectful, and that's generally what they do, because they do have other clients during the course of the day, not just that one.
Now, do you recommend, in order to take advantage of the technology that's out there now, recommend that before they go out, they look at the pictures that are available for the house on any of these real estate signs, Zillow, Realtor.com, Trulia, and like, there's probably others out there. Do you recommend that say, okay, we're going to look at these 5 properties, you know, why don't you go ahead and take a look at them before we go out? Or you just say, let's go blind, look at them, and, you know, see them, you know, up close and personal?
Okay, generally speaking, I like the idea of sending the clients the homes based on their preferences, and then having them make a decision of what they want to see. I prefer to do it that way, because then I'm showing them something that they are already sort of, based on the pictures, are familiar with, and they're making the choice for themselves in terms of, I want to see this. I don't want to take a client out and not understanding their specification, and then I take them out and they're disappointed. Disappointed in how the home looks after them viewing it, that's one thing. But disappointed because I'm showing them something that doesn't meet with their specification, I try not to do that. I try
how
to respect what they want.
Okay. How do you help a client narrow down their, and I guess I'm going to use the word non-negotiables. In other words, the house has to absolutely have this, this, and this, and that. How do you help them in that process? Because I would think that, you know, if you're looking at ranches, but you like 2 stories, or you want 5 acres and you're showing only a half acre, I mean, you know, you want a big kitchen, small kitchen, you want a den, you want a basement. What are the things that you look at in terms of dealing with that?
Again, one of the things that I do is just based on their specification, and to know exactly that they can afford the house that they're looking for. So that's where the pre-approval comes in. Once I know that, for example, they're approved for $200,000, then I know that I'm not going to take it to a house that's $500,000. I'm not going to take it to a, even if that's what you want to see, I'm not going to waste your time or my time to take you to a house that's $500,000, because you will never be able to afford that. So usually for me, it's the pre-approval that determines whether or not I show you something that you might want but don't qualify for.
Right. And I guess, you know, I was speaking in that too, in terms of the price of the house, because I think buyers generally always want more than what they can afford once they start looking at stuff, you know. And then after a while, I've been there, done that, and then after a while, you know, you start looking at, you know, if you go out and look at 10 properties one weekend and 10 the next, I mean, once you get over 10 properties, they all start coming together. How do you help them, you know, kind of narrow down what they're looking for? How do you help them in that process? Because sometimes they don't know, particularly if it's a first-time home buyer. But somebody that's, say, you know, buying a new home or whatever, moving out of a current residence into a new one might be a little different. But someone who's a first-time home buyer, they may not actually, you know what they want. So how do you help them narrow that down? Like, you know, what type of kitchen you want? What type, how do you help them with that process? Or do you help them with that process?
The truth is, buyers are, in this age of technology, buyers are more knowledgeable than, say, maybe 14 years ago when I just started out. They're more knowledgeable. They already know exactly what they want. So that's why I say it's basically based on their budget in this case. Because of technology, they have different sites available to them so they could search and see exactly what they want. As long, for me anyway, as long as I can afford it, as long as they can afford it, I am taking them based on their specifications. So,
gotcha.
Again, it, for me, it just boils down to, even if they are a first-time homeowner, a lot of times they come with lots of knowledge, and if anything that they don't have, I'll try to assist them and point them in the direction that they need to go. But generally speaking, they're very knowledgeable, and they know exactly what they want. Just, can you afford it? And that's the important thing.
Good, good. Because I think now, you know, people start looking for a home, you know, what? Do people start looking for homes 6 months out, a year out, 2 years out? How far out do the clients that come to you, how far out do they go before they're, you know, start engaging a real estate agent? Or I guess maybe the more specific question is, how soon should you engage a real estate agent? I mean, you know, should you, you know, be ready to buy, like, you know, if you find something that you like, or can you start working, say, a year out?
Typically a year to 6 months, they start looking.
Okay.
When it gets closer to the time frame that, say, they want to, like, their lease is up, XYZ, maybe 90 days prior to, you start preparing yourself to get that pre-approval. And then once you do that, or you get an agent, you find an agent, and that agent could assist you with pointing you to the direction of getting a lender. So either way, it's about 90 days prior to exactly when you want to officially move in. But generally speaking, you could start looking a year, 6 months before.
In selecting a real estate agent, and I'm just going to talk about the Atlanta area. The Atlanta area is so huge, okay? Is it important to have a real estate agent that works a particular area of town? Because Atlanta is, you know, we've got, what, 13 counties or something like that? That's a lot, you know. So should you be looking for a real estate agent that works a part of town that you're looking to purchase your home in?
The truth is, sometimes, depending, it might be better to have somebody who is more knowledgeable within that county. But also, the truth is, again, because of technology, we all, as agents, have access to the same information. So all we have to do, based on your preference of where you want to live, is do our homework. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Just do our research and then get back to you and let you know, okay, XYZ is the best area, the best schools. We have all the information at our fingertips to do that research for you. But generally speaking, you might want to go with somebody who's more knowledgeable about that area.
That area. But an agent, if they're a professional agent and know what they're doing, they can research any particular area and give you some insight into what would be a good, you know, house to buy, how much you're going to pay for it, and, you know, where you should consider living. Okay. That's important.
That's correct.
Can you hire more than one agent?
No. I think, honestly, okay, I say absolutely not. Because
okay.
I am doing my research for you based on your specification. I'm taking time out of my day and working with you individually as my client. That is unfair to another agent to go and do the same thing, because if they come up with something, they have lost all. If another agent, say for example, I'm working with someone, and that client then decides to go and get another agent and do the same thing that I'm doing, if that, I've worked with that person for months or weeks or whatever, and that person comes up and automatically is fine in 2 days, how fair is it to the other agent? So honestly, I've always pretty much asked my clients, once I get to know them a little bit and know what they want and realize that I could assist them, I then turn around and ask them to sign an exclusive buyer's agent agreement.
Okay.
So
that makes sense.
We are working exclusively with each other.
And that makes sense.
So the answer is no.
Right. The answer is no. Okay. Duly noted. So, one of the things is that, you know, and in terms of, you mentioned, you know, working at least a year out, 6 months to maybe to a year out, based on how people process information, how many homes, in your experience, have people had to look at before they actually purchase, put a contract on a house? How many houses in general have they looked at?
I've had people that purchase, in general, maybe about 20, 30.
Okay.
Physically looking at those houses. But you already know that online they've been doing their own research. So physically going and looking at those houses, because I've had times where I've sent maybe 20 houses to someone, and out of that 20, they only want to see one or two. So maybe about 20 or 30.
Okay. So in your process of working with a client, that you're going to send them properties, I guess, via email for them to look at, and then, you know, do they select the property to look at, or do you say, I think I want to show you these? How does that interchange work?
I think it works both ways. I send it to them, and they could make a decision and say, okay, I just want to see. Say I send them 10. They'll make a decision and say, I only want to see 5. But the day when I've made the appointment, if I find another one that fits their criteria, I'm going to add it to it. So it works both ways.
Okay. So it's kind of like a meeting of the mind. They look at properties, say, hey, I think
that's
this is a good
correct.
Property for to look at, and those kinds of things in terms of being
and
able
that's
to
why, and you're correct. And that's why you have to know your client and understand your client. You have to understand exactly what they're looking for, so, you know, you give them what they want. So if they only found in the set maybe 3 or 4, that day I'll look again just to make sure, and then I'll add whatever as long as it meets, you know.
You seem to be a really patient person. Have you ever worked with a client that you had to fire and say, like, okay, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I mean, what are the
things? Oh, yeah.
Really? Okay. So
oh, yeah.
I'm assuming that a potential buyer can fire an agent, but you also have done the opposite. What type of things would annoy you in terms of a relationship with a client? What type of things would get in the way?
In the years that I've done it, there are two that drove me crazy. One was because she was undecided. And, like, we'll make a plan of action, and then she'll change it. And it literally took, I want to say maybe about 8 months. And this is 8 months of consistently working with her before she decided on a house. And I swear, this was in 2012, and I had to think twice about renewing my license, I swear, after her. It was horrific.
Wow,
the
that bad.
The good part about it is that she's still a friend.
And some people can be difficult. That's why I know in sales, you got to be very, very patient and, you know, have a lot of customer relationship skills because, yeah, I guess people can really, you know, tick you off if they take you around. If you show somebody 50, 60, 70 properties and they haven't found one that they like, I would assume either they're not being you know, serious, or they're not being as candid as they should be in letting you know what they're looking for. And that would be a headache having to deal with that. So walk us through. Now, we've gone through some of the regular kinds of stuff, you know, in terms of, you know, getting folks ready to buy and that kind of thing. But walk us through your protocol. What is it that you do? Because every agent is different. But what is it that you do to prepare yourself and your buyer to go look for properties? What is it that you walk us through that process? Matter of fact, I'm going to let you think about that, okay? I'm going to have to give you a couple of minutes to think about that. We're going to play another segment of your personal finance, but I want you to think about what steps do you go through when a client contacts you and you decide to take them on. Deal?
Okay.
All right.
Is there a multi-level marketing company in your future? Find out on today's Your Personal Finance.
When the engineering passionate Dodge explodes, boldness, strength, and style come together. Dodge puts it all on the line with cars and trucks distinctively designed and precisely engineered. Cars on the cutting edge of technology, and trucks that let you flex your muscles with Magnum power and serious 4x4 strength. This is Dodge, where cars and trucks are setting new standards and redefining power and style. Take the Dodge Intrepid. With its optional 225 horsepower aluminum engine and aggressive coupe-like styling, Intrepid is good to go. And the versatile Dodge Durango Sport Utility Vehicle, with your choice of two Magnum V8 engines, an optional third seat, and Infinity speaker system, Durango is ready for some serious pumping. So when you're ready to make that move, don't go camouflage, go Dodge. Dodge. Different.
Multi-level marketing can have many attractions, one being the chance to supplement your finances with extra income. Also, the level of personal satisfaction can be high, with appreciation coming to each participant. The sense of belonging has a strong appeal, too. MLMs thrive in areas of the country where people tend to be friendly, like in California and the South. They don't do well in the Northeast. Distributors are encouraged to attend meetings and rallies, which can include slogans, singing, and testimonials, often creating the same electrifying atmosphere as a church revival. These companies offer the entrepreneur the opportunity to start a business for as little as $100. Tomorrow, what you should know before joining a multi-level marketing company. For Your Personal Finance, I'm Charles Ross.
And we're back with Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross and Wendy Warren, real estate agent. And we're just about to wrap it up. She's just going to kind of go through the process that she goes through to engage a prospective real estate client. I'm assuming we're working on the buyer side, okay, that you're working on the buyer side. Okay, all right, go ahead. What's the process that you go through?
Okay, the first thing I do is actually get an understanding of what they're looking for, the areas, the locations that they're looking for, and the price range that they're looking for. Once I understand that, my next question to them is, have you been pre-approved? If they have, I ask for that letter just to make sure that it's good and reach out possibly to the lender, letting them know that I will be the agent that's working with that particular client. And then, of course, I start, based on their criteria and specification, I start sending them properties. And then we start the process of looking for the place.
How often? Okay, all right, and that summarizes kind of what we've been talking about. How often should a client be going out to look at properties? Is it once a week, once or twice a month? How often should they go out looking at properties?
I don't think there is a set schedule. I think it's based on both people's availability. It could be two, it could be three. It depends on when they're available and when that agent is available.
Got it. But I would think at least once a month. I mean, if you're really serious, depending on how far it out, I would think, you know, to some extent. I mean, you wouldn't want to go out every 2 or 3 months looking, right? I mean, that would sound...
If you're talking about in that sense, absolutely not. To me, that unless they've made a decision to stop looking, period, and start all over again later on, that's a different story. No, it has to be at least a weekly visit.
A week.
Definitely serious. Yes.
Right. And looking at, like you said, 5 properties in a month's time. Yeah.
Correct.
That's about 20 or so. I know when I've looked at properties, after a while, they all start looking together. And I think one of the things that I have heard recommended is that, you know, that they take notes, you know, on properties that they're looking at.
That's
that they like, that kind of thing. Because they'll forget. I mean, they'll look at the pictures.
That's correct. That's absolutely one of the things that I do. When I have a client that I'm showing them 2 properties, generally speaking, I don't really give them a printout of the home. But if it's multiple 5, 6, 7, they're not going to remember. Shoot, I'm not going to remember. And so it's easier for them to understand. And when they go back and settle in and they start looking back on the different properties, they need to have some notes from each visit as a reminder of what's in the house, what's wrong with the house, what they love about the house, what they don't like about the house. Because as you just stated, it will definitely start running into one.
Let's talk projection, and we're getting ready to wrap up in just a few minutes. The pandemic, that's all over the world, all over the country, all over Georgia, all over Atlanta. How is that affecting, real estate prices, and then number two, interest rates?
Well, interest rates has dropped since the pandemic, so that's one thing. So that's a good thing for buyers and sellers, too. In Atlanta here, I can tell you that if the property is in really, really good shape, that property will be gone in a matter of hours. And one of the reasons why is because inventory is kind of low. Based on same time last year, it's a little bit lower because people are not willing to actually have someone come to their house or as a buyer to go out and look at this point. So inventory is really down. So if something comes on the market and is in great shape or great bones or even need just cosmetic repairs, that will be gone in a matter of days.
Because I think
now,
that I think on the side of the selling part, I guess, you know, and I'm on two sides in this. I would think on the selling part that there are some people saying, well, my economic or financial or job prospects is a little uncertain, so I'm not going to get out there and try to buy a house. Or they're older and they just don't feel like moving right now. But on the other side, it sounds like there's more buyers than there are sellers. And I'm assuming those buyers are feeling more confident about their economic prospects. And so they're willing to, whether it's first-time home buyers or folks that are, you know, going out buying a second or third home or whatever the case may be. So I don't quite understand that, you know, why the inventory is so low when you have this uncertainty in the economic environment right now. And that affects everybody because right now you can say, hey, I got a job, but a month or two later you may not. And I've heard lenders actually asking applicants to get a letter to indicate that they will have a job, I don't know, in the next 3 months,
correct.
That which doesn't really mean anything because, you know, your boss might say, yeah, you have a job, but then something happens in 30, 60 days, you're out of a job. So I understand that. So I'm not quite sure if I understand, you know, why the inventory, maybe you can help me with that, why the inventory is so low and there's more buyers.
I think it's on the seller side that the inventory is low. A lot of people have decided that they don't want to sell right now based on they don't want folks walking in their homes. So I think that's why the inventory is low. The inventory is always from the selling side. So if you don't have 30, 40 properties out there selling, I'm just using that small number, but if you don't have 30, 40 properties out there selling at one time, then it's going to be a low inventory. On the other hand, the buyers are looking for houses with the least amount of work that they have to do. So if that house is in great shape, great bones, minimal, it will be gone.
So is this a good time to buy?
It is a good time to buy.
Okay.
The interest rate is pretty low.
Okay. And a lot of refinancing is going on as well, I hear. A lot of people are refinancing their property. Your opinion, home inspection, appraisal is going to be done anyway from the lender's side, but if the lender doesn't, you know, sponsor an inspector, is it a good idea to get an inspection of the property that looks at, you know, the electrical systems, the heating and air system, the plumbing, the structure, the roof, and all that? Is that a good expense, you know, to incur when buying a home?
That is absolutely one of the best money you will ever spend. Going into that home, you want to know, even if no matter what you're going to buy the house, you want to know up front what is wrong, what is right. Not only that, having that inspector, you'll know, if you're not knowledgeable about homes, you'll know where the water lock off is, you'll know where the power grid is, you'll know everything that you need to know about the house just walking through with that inspector. So I think having an inspector is a very important part of buying a home. The first thing that you should do after you sign that contract is get an inspector.
And what type of things does an inspector? I've listed some of them, but did I cover all the things that an home inspector will look at?
Roofing. Most inspectors visually look at the roof. But
okay.
Roof, heating, cooling, plumbing, electrical. And
they look at. Do they look at structure, like, you know, the foundation?
Yeah,
good?
That's what I was going to say.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, structural, just to make sure that everything is good.
Good.
And then,
good.
Of course, some of the cosmetic stuff that, I don't know, for example, just to give you an example, my kitchen pipe was leaking, and I was like, oh, Lord, I have to go repair my... Turns out that somebody put the washer on incorrectly. It was as simple as that. So some of those things that, you know, you have an idea of what's wrong, what to do before.
Got it. Anything that you want to share before we go? We got about a minute or two left. Anything you want to share that we haven't covered?
No, I think we've covered pretty much everything about the buying and as a buyer's agent, and even as a selling agent. As a seller, you need to prepare your home, visually prepare your home, probably get an inspector also, and repair anything that buyer's inspector might find beforehand. So those are some of the things that you could do as a seller. Prepare that home for people to come in and view by the cosmetic painting, just sprucing up the house. And then probably do a inspection again, just to make sure that you have taken care of everything. You know, sometimes you live in the house and you don't do your regular maintenance. When you're selling that home, just to make sure that the buyer's not going to come back and say, oh, I need $30,000 off because this is wrong, that is wrong, this is wrong. You do your own inspection yourself. Take care of what things that need to be taken care of, and after that, have a great sale.
Awesome. If folks want to engage your services, how can they find you?
Yes. I do have a Facebook page, Wendy Morin, your real estate agent on Facebook. And also, my number is 678-468-8916. My email address is wnw aj123@yahoo.com.
Awesome. All right, Wendy. Well, thank you so much for sharing with our listeners on how to buy a house. You would think that most people know how to do that, but there are a lot of folks that move to Atlanta and they're looking for a good real estate agent. And obviously, you're one of the best out there. So we thank you so much for sharing on your personal finance.
Thank you very much, Charles, for having me on. And you have a great evening.
All righty. Take care now.
Thanks.
And we thank Wendy Warren for coming on and being a part of Your Personal Finance with Dr. Charles Ross. And, you know, buying a house is a huge investment. I recommend that you take the time to engage Wendy Warren as your real estate agent or real estate agent to get the process done. But some of the things we talked about in terms of getting ready, make sure you're ready so you don't waste a real estate agent's time, like the things we talked about, cleaning up your credit, making sure you know how much of a monthly payment you can afford, which will translate into, you know, how much of a house you can get, making sure you're pre-approved. That's very important. And that lets, you know, sellers know that you're not kicking tires, that you're serious about, you know, what you're getting ready to buy and that you can afford it and that the deal will close. Thank you so much for being a part of this show. And we're going to kind of head on out with a little Barry White, Rhapsody in White. Thank you so much for listening.